This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Believe it or not, our sixth anniversary.
Six.
We have been on the air, or over the internet, however you say it, for six freaking years.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Easter Bunny of the Education Reform Movement, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
Now, I know that you are of Jewish heritage. Is it okay that I call you the Easter Bunny?
I was going to actually ask about that. How did I score Easter Bunny status?
Well, it's just that Easter's coming up, and I don't know. You kind of remind me of an Easter Bunny. You're kind of cute and hoppy.
Oh,
bouncy.
I like that.
Yeah.
Free?
Yeah. Does Passover have an animal like that or a mascot?
No. It's like, you know, it's like the vast majority of Jewish holidays. It's mostly about relatively tedious snack fare.
I know. So, what is up with that?
I don't know, man. You know, Passover, you eat matzah for 8 days.
Right.
It's about charoset, which is basically like nuts and mushed apple stuff.
Did they eat like crap back then? Is that what the bottom line is?
I don't know. I've just always thought, as far as holiday celebratory stuff.
Yeah.
And then the food that goes along.
Yeah.
Christian denominations just get a far better deal than do the Jews.
Now, is the matzah stuff, is that gluten-free?
You know, I'm sure you can get a gluten-free version.
You probably can. I mean, because that's big these days, too.
Mm.
Gluten. Who knew? It's such a menace. All right. Let's get started. A lot to cover this week. And you know what this week is, Rick? Believe it or not, our sixth anniversary.
Six.
We have been on the air, or over the internet, however you say it, for six freaking years.
6 years.
Can you believe it? Ever since those first days, the Tom Loveless interview by phone. The Nina Reese interview where you called her a mid-major.
It was this time of year.
Yeah, yeah. What, like a Baylor or something? She's like a mid-major?
No. She was more like George Mason. It was the year I think George Mason made his run to the Final Four.
Nice. So many years have gone by. We're going to talk about the day, that, as well as some more timely issues. Let's get started. And Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Rick, last week you wrote that you have seen the future, and the Common Core turned out to be a flop. Are you convinced that it's destined to fail?
No, nothing's destined. It's like the theme of Back to the Future, that the future is what we make of it. So in that column, I had the good luck to travel to 2022 and see things then and report back. Whether or not the Common Core advocates, are able to make use of what I brought back is, really, like Doc Brown says to Michael J. Fox at the end of Back to the Future 3. You know, it's future's in your hands, Marty. It's what you make of it.
So I hope you're going to be writing another piece where this all comes out great.
No.
Why not?
Because far more likely is the way I wrote it right now, I think.
Oh, Rick, poo-pooing the Common Core.
Well, especially what I like is I like the number of, some of the really thoughtful Common Core leaders, half a dozen or 12 of them, state chiefs and folks at NGNC, wrote me really nice notes saying, hey, these are good things. We're wrestling with this. That's useful. What's interesting is the people a notch or two down the food chain, the number of notes I got that said, why are you trying to drum up trouble? You don't understand what's going on. You're out of touch. And I think that's really what's going on. A lot of the people who are doing the tough work here have really developed a case of tunnel vision.
You know, there are some people who view it as their job to keep all of the states on board with the Common Core. And so they're worried about any negative messages out there. I think that's a mistake. And this is truly a state-led effort, and it's truly voluntary, then we shouldn't be afraid if some states drop out. Some states should drop out. Look at South Carolina, where the governor and the state legislature seems to be against the Common Core. They also have pretty good standards already. Let them drop out. I don't think that's a big problem or a big loss. If this was a case of state board signing on to something that didn't have broader political support, drop out, because there's a lot of work ahead. And the worst thing is for people to minimize this and say, this isn't a big change. This is a tweak. We can keep doing what we're doing, and now the standards are just a little different. For most states, these are dramatically more challenging standards and are going to require very different teaching than we've had before. And if states aren't up for it, and it's going to take some money, and it's going to take commitment, it's going to take all the things that it takes to change practice in the classroom, and that's not for the faint of heart. And so there's got to be local and state leadership that buys into it.
I got to tell you, I don't think that message is getting out to state legislators and to education leaders. That is not – That is not the way they talk about the Common Core when I'm chatting with them when I'm out on the road.
Clearly, the problem is that they're not listening to the Education Gadfly Show. Mm. So, folks, if you know a state legislator or another person like that,
but do you agree? I mean, Mike, do you think I am underestimating how much awareness there is?
You know, no, I think you're probably right. I mean, I think there's more awareness like that at the state chief level and maybe some of their people in the departments of ed. I don't think there's great awareness below that. And we are worried here at Fordham that there have been some cases of state leaders downplaying how much of a change this is going to be. And because they'd want to tell people, don't be angry at us teachers. I know you just got used to our standards. Now we're changing, moving your cheese on you. Don't worry, it's not a big change. And I think that that's a tempting message for state leaders, but it's dead wrong. Topic number two.
Over the course of the Education Gadfly Show's six-year lifetime, where have reformers gotten it right?
6 years, Ricky. What this goes back to 2006. Let's see. We didn't reauthorize No Child Left Behind, so that doesn't count. We just talked about Common Core. Are there some promising signs when you look back over those 6 years? Lots have changed. I mean, a lot of things have happened.
I think the biggest change and the thing they've gotten most right is reformers have woken up to the importance of politics here.
Oh, sorry.
Pause?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, start over.
I think the thing reformers have gotten most right is they've woken up to the importance of politics. You think back to 06, that was that ridiculous Stand Up for Education stuff on Oprah. It was about 05 or 06. This was even before Ed in 08. You didn't have DFER. You didn't have Students First. I don't think you even had Khan Can, much less 50 Can. I don't think you had Stand. So, this entire network of folks that are out there advocating and agitating. Now, sometimes I think they approach it wrong. Sometimes I think they oversell. But you didn't have any of that political infrastructure. And I think that has just been, a tremendous change.
Yeah, and what I would say on the positive side is this focus on teacher policy. Again, I worry about some of the specifics, but I think a lot of us in school reform, especially from the choice side, had this theory that if we just created enough competition, the districts would respond positively. And I think what we finally came to see is that the districts didn't have the freedom of action to respond in many cases because state law was tying their hands, especially around who they hire and who they fire and how all that stuff works. And so that meant you had to go after the state policies themselves. And so I think that, we have seen that happening. I mean, the progress we've made on LIFO, for example, and some of the teacher evaluation stuff is at least an indication that we're getting more serious and not pretending that, that market forces alone would be enough.
And by the way, on that, choice alone isn't going to cause districts to change what they're doing. I am still waiting for my nice note from the choice community saying, hey, guy. Okay, maybe you weren't so anti-choice all along. That and a couple of flowers and maybe a chocolate bar.
It might be in your spam folder. You should look there. Okay, topic number three.
On the flip side, where has reform gone off the rails in those years?
Wow, how do we count the ways? No, I mean, look, there's obviously been a backlash, especially on testing. And I think we are stuck in many cases with accountability systems that just don't work. They identify too many schools as, quote, failing, and that means that they don't have much legitimacy and much effect in terms of identifying the schools that do need help. I think that those systems have too often been demoralizing instead of motivating. So you want educators to see the accountability system and say, hey, okay, like if I put in this effort or if I make smart decisions or if I'm a principal and I make tough calls, I have a chance of looking better under this system. And with the way AYP works and the rest of the NCLB architecture, that just hasn't been the case in too many states. And so, and strangely enough, the people who call themselves accountability hawks seem to be the ones pushing to keep that status quo in place. And I think it's just hurting their own cause that they care so much about.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know that I would disagree with that. I'll go even a little broader. I say the biggest problem is that, the school reform conversation for the last, certainly for the last 5 years has been entirely driven by progressives. And progressives, many of my dear friends, they have an admirable impulse, which is when they see a societal problem, they want to solve it. They don't just want to alleviate it here. They want to solve it for everybody. And the way you solve societal problems is through public policies. Now, the trick is that a lot of what they want to do through policy, I'm just not that sure that you can do competently or well through policy. Most importantly, policy can make people do things, but like Mike and I have written, it can't make them do them well. So when we look at, you know, the rush towards teacher evaluation policies today, teacher compensation, we see crude, for my part, simple-minded, one-size-fits-all systems being built across entire states in which we are insisting that every teacher in the entirety of Florida is going to be evaluated in the same way, is going to have salary driven in the same way. And I think, you know, when we look back in 5 or 8 years, we're going to go, man, that just defies common sense. What were we thinking? The backlash was utterly predictable. Mm-hmm. The ideas were right. But why in God's name did we have to be such petty bureaucrats about how do you put them in place?
You know, one last point going broad is just overselling reform, not being willing to be honest, that even with the best policies, as you say, we are not going to close the achievement gap. We're not going to get every kid growing up in poverty to graduate from a rigorous four-year institution, college. I mean, that what we should be looking at is progress. We want to see if we can get more kids to higher levels of education, more attainment, higher achievement. And that's why we don't have to get mired in this whole question about poverty and everything else to the degree that we have recently. You know, it was 10 years ago that a lot of the education groups were saying, look, it's not fair to judge schools based on these proficiency rates. We should look at growth. Well, now we have growth. And so the opponents of reform have changed again and say, well, it's not even enough to look at growth. You know, poverty is the issue. The problem is that too many reformers continue to say we're going to get 100% of kids to college and career readiness. If we were more willing to say that, no, we're going to look at growth. And what we're saying is if kids come in 3 years behind, we want to catch them up. But we're not promising that we're going to get everybody ready for Harvard by the time they're 18. More of that kind of honesty than I think would be wise. But instead, we have these shoot the moon pronouncements. And of course, we come up short and there's this cycle of frustration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a lot to cover in those 6 years. I don't know, these conversations usually leave me depressed.
Mm.
What about you? Are you more of a glass half full guy?
I'm always depressed. So, you know, yeah. It's just... You know, I know I've had a good conversation when other people leave the conversation feeling equally glum.
Rick Hess, working on behalf of the nation's pharmaceutical companies, producing those antidepressants. Okay, that's all the time for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite for most of those 6 years we've been on the air. Well, half of them at least. Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
How long have you been with us here on the Education Gadfly Show?
I think, did I start right when I came? I think I did. So mm-hmm. About 4 years.
When did you start at Fordham?
Been here about 4 years.
That's amazing.
4 years ago?
Can you believe that?
4 years?
And you know who found Amber for us? Rick Hess.
Mm-hmm.
One man employment agency.
Yes, indeed.
That worked out
pretty good.
Extraordinaire.
That worked out pretty good.
Yeah.
Not too shabby.
And Amber, I remember Amber being all worried about. She was regretting leaving her narrow following 17 teachers in a 6-year pilot evaluation because she was like, I don't know. I'm going to miss the chance to be an expert in something really tiny and small. I can.
Yeah, you were actually very diplomatic when you questioned me about that. You weren't like, you idiot. You actually asked me a thoughtful question, which I appreciated.
And now, of course, Amber actually knows nothing like us about what's happening on the ground in education.
Exactly.
And gets to read studies for 1 minute on a show and act like I know something.
So she was right.
She was right.
You're so
right.
That's why I was so gracious, because you were making perfect sense.
All right, Amber, let's do it. You've got your 1 minute. What are we talking about today?
New Mathematica report out with Center on Reinventing Public Ed. This is the partnered up to do their follow-up on successful charter management organizations. You guys remember this report. So this is the in-depth analysis of two practices, school-wide student behavior programs and teacher coaching, that were shown to be strongly and consistently associated with the most successful CMOs, meaning that other CMOs in regular public schools do not emphasize these policies. So they're going to name CMOs this time. Imagine that, because these are the good CMOs that are doing good stuff. So they looked at Aspire, Inner City Education Foundation, or ICEF, KIPP DC, Uncommon Schools, and Yes Prep. Analysts used survey and interview data to characterize both policies in detail. They found that the behavior policies encourage consistent application in classrooms by teachers and consistent consequences for students failing to meet them, whereby the behavioral expectations become routine for everybody. The CMOs also
used... Whoa, back up.
Earth-shattering. The CMOs also use a merit and demerit system to bolster the rules. And the second practice, teacher coaching, it takes the form of frequent teacher observations with rapid feedback, targeted to specific teacher needs and aligned to school goals. Coaches are also given the authority, believe it or not, to take action if teachers do not respond to their suggestions.
Oh, whoa. Back up.
Am I done with my minute? Am I really done? I have two more sentences.
Rick.
In the end, these seem like common sense strategies to yours truly. But both are obviously much easier to implement when a school is A, started from scratch, B, administrators have the ability to selectively hire and fire office staff and school staff. Staff are like-minded, they choose to be there, so on and so forth. So it's hard to see how some of these policies can be transferred to the traditional school sector.
Not that they won't waste their time
trying to
focusing on the tip of the iceberg and ignoring the 6th-7ths.
So, right, that's what you say. They're just going to take the what looks like the easy stuff.
Yeah, well, they're going to say, oh, well, we're already doing that. They're saying we already have coaches who work with our teachers. Mm-hmm. And they're going to say we already have technical behavior policies mm-hmm. on the books. So we're doing everything we possibly can to emulate these schools.
Now, do you think the Apollo project down there in Houston that's trying to take the lessons from these high-flying charter schools, would you say the same thing about that, or they've really tried to go deeper?
So, I mean, I think it depends. There's like seven design elements, the way they're, you know, the way HISD and Ed Labs are doing that. And I think, you know, partly, I mean, Houston has a lot of flexibility that they were able to exploit, and they actually were very thoughtful about how they designed these. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this is the problem, right? When folks try to emulate best practices, is what they focus on typically is, oh, they read, like, the five-point thing you're supposed to do. You're supposed to mentor the teacher. You're supposed to have behavioral codes mm-hmm. and clear expectations. And they do that. They put the poster on the wall. Mm-hmm. They have three observational visits a year. And what they ignore is kind of all the stuff underwater, which is how does that structure of the iceberg kind of allow you to do this stuff seriously, mm-hmm. to make people believe in it, to get people that are committed to it.
Yeah. The behavioral stuff in particular is interesting. I mean, you've said this before, Rick, that you know, KIPP schools don't seem all that innovative. They just do the traditional school model much better. I mean, how long have schools used merits and demerits, right?
Yeah, buddy, I used to use them.
Right. But you're not even that old, Amber. I'm talking about like 100 years, right? I mean, this is something that's been around a long time.
Well, I mean, like our parents, I remember my dad, he got hit by the ruler on the knuckles, you know? It's like, swap.
Remember your great brain books? Remember? Tom was always, the older brother Tom was always getting all those demerits.
I love that book. I love those books. Now, some people will say, though, that you look at what KIPP does and some of these other schools do, and they say that they are too tough on these kids. Yes. You wouldn't treat middle-class kids like this. People say that KIPP is kids in prison program. Have you heard that one before?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that this is something we only do to those poor black and Latino kids. You would never think about doing it to upper-middle-class white kids. I mean, what is that fair? Is this treating kids inhumanely or disrespectfully?
I don't think so, and I don't think it is a class thing. I mean, I think it can be applied to any kid who's misbehaving. I mean, I don't know. I don't see it. I don't see it that way at all.
I mean, I don't think it's a race thing. I mean, I think there's definitely class dimensions, but I think, you know, it's Delpit. I think it's the reality that kids from two parent families who've been read to, who've been taught to, you know, who've been taught to behave, who have large vocabularies when they start school, are simply in a different place and are positioned to receive different kinds of instruction and are comfortable with it than kids who haven't had that kind of strong adult supervision, whatever race they are, than kids who haven't have been exposed to those same learning opportunities and who haven't been raised in the same way. Schools, I mean, to my mind, one of the things they need to do is give kids which they're not getting at home. And there is a progression here that it's hard to get kids, like you wrote about in the Alfie Cohn piece a couple weeks ago. It's hard to get kids engaged in constructivist education when they can't sit down, when there's no self-control, and when they don't understand kind of the content. So it's E.D. Hirsch. You know, what these schools are doing is these are schools for kids who have gotten totally shafted at the start of life and are trying to catch them up where they're going to have a fair shot. And if folks want to turn that into an ideological contest, I think that's unfortunate.
I mean, having gone to a private college preparatory high school, I can tell you that there are, I mean, there are outliers, but obviously kids who are really privileged, whose parents leave for a month to go to the Caribbean or Europe or whatever, I mean, they act out, you know, they want attention. So it's not, you know, it can cross class lines, I think.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay. Amber, we have no song. We have no quiz.
No song? No
we quiz. We have a bare bone right. research minute.
Tell a joke.
That's right. We are now, and actually a knock-knock joke, if you can.
Oh, seriously? Y'all are going to get, I have no knock-knock
Okay, here you go. Well, you remember the joke, Pulp Fiction came out just like 13 years before our first show.
Oh, yeah.
So we can do Uma Thurman's joke, remember from the end of her date with John Travolta?
I'm forgetting how that goes.
Papa Tomato, Mama Tomato, and Baby Tomato are walking along. Mama and Papa Tomato up front. Papa Tomato turns around, looks at Baby Tomato, and says, "Ketchup."
That's a good one.
I do remember it now.
My son likes that one. Thanks, Amber, for coming on the show.
You're welcome, Mike.
All right, Rick, that's the end of our 6th anniversary show. We'll see you in another 6 years.
Sounds good, baby.
But really, till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.